This week on Capitalism, Race, and Democracy.
We sit here in the belly of the beast. We have a critical role to play in stopping this beast from being able to function.
We hear from Ajamu Umi of the All African People's Revolutionary Party about the upcoming U.S. military draft, the petrodollar, French colonialism on the decline, protests in the streets of Kenya, and South Africa's elections.
The former general commander of Bolivia's army, Juan José Zuniga, was removed from his position. He's been charged with an attempted coup after he deployed a military operation in Plaza Murillo in the capital city of La Paz, aiming to strip power from the constitutional government.
A failed coup in Bolivia last week raises questions.
What to the American slave is your 4th of July? I answer, it is a day that reveals to him more than any other day of the year the gross conduct and cruelty to which he is the constant victim. To him, your celebration is a sham.
Frederick Douglass's speech, What to the Negro is the 4th of July? From Pacifica Radio, this is Capitalism, Race, and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from Pacifica stations and affiliates across the U.S. I'm your host, Akua Holt. J.R. Valray of Block Report Radio spoke to Ajamu Umi of the All African People's Revolutionary Party about the upcoming U.S. military draft, the petrodollar, French colonialism on the decline, and what is happening on the streets of Kenya and South Africa's election.
What are your thoughts behind what's going on with this U.S. draft, and what do you think it says about the political climate of the United States as well as the world?
Well, I think the fact that the discussion has arisen about resurrecting a military draft speaks to the desperation of the empire, you know, to ensure that its interests are protected all over the world. That's why they need to, you know, have this conversation right now. But, you know, I think it's important that we remember that the reason why the draft got smashed in the 60s was because of the work of organizations like the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, right? They did work all over the country, and they were able to raise people's consciousness about the fact that the U.S. military represents the interests of empire. So this turned people against, this created a mass movement that turned people completely against the entire draft process, and they had to relinquish it. And in the war in Vietnam, during that period. So now today in 2024, we have to talk about the same type of approach to make sure people understand this nonsense and can get engaged to stop it from happening.
Also connected to this draft, a few days prior, the United States and Saudi Arabia were in negotiations about the petrodollar. The petrodollar is what's responsible for backing the U.S. dollar along with military aggression.
Yeah.
Now, with Saudi Arabia basically saying that they are not going to renegotiate the contract with the United States where they will only deal in dollars, they will let other countries deal in foreign currencies. Why is this an important step in world economics and in the world political front? What does this mean for the United States empire, and what do you see ahead?
Well, I think these types of things are happening in many arenas, right? And they're a reflection of the capitalist system in the state of decline that it's in. Like, it's this system is no longer capable of just dominating all of the world resource economies like it has done over the last 60, 70, 80 years. So now people are, you know, standing up and they're asserting what they perceive as their rights to control the resources that they perceive that they should control. But I think for us as African people, and as Pan-Africanists, we look at this as a question of the wealth that exists in this empire, this capitalist empire, and that has been built within this empire has been built largely on stealing resources from Africa. You can't use the internet without African resources. You can't drive a Tesla without African resources. You can't. 60% of the oil comes from Nigeria. 75% of the chocolate products consumed here come from Ghana. So the concept of Pan-Africanism and the work around that is about us developing control through revolution over our resources so that we're not in this position where we're subservient to the U.S. empire, but we can begin to assert our rights as 2 billion people across the planet to dictate what type of political and economic conditions we want to live in.
I know that we're talking a lot about resistance. There seems to be a lot going on in the colonial space of France. You have
right.
New Caledonia going up,
right.
which is an island nation that France right. colonized. You also have Haiti that's going mm-hmm. up, and they're trying, basically the West is trying to recolonize it. But you also have the Sahel, where there are a number
right.
of African nations that are turning their back to French colonialism. What can you tell us about what's going on with France? What do you see going on in the Sahel, Haiti? How are they united with the black struggle in the United States?
Yeah, so people may be, or if you're not, you should be familiar with the Thomas Sankara Center for Liberation and Pan-African Unity in Burkina Faso. That's the APRP in Burkina Faso. And we also have a budding chapter in people in Mali and Niger. So, you know, we have our ear to the ground from the comrades over there in terms of the work they're doing and what's actually happening. And I think, you know, you're seeing these mass uprisings in these Sahel countries. And what they're bringing attention to is the criminal nature of France, and not just France, but all of these imperialist countries, the U.S., Britain, Canada, the Zionist state of Israel, all of them. But particularly in this question, the question of France, today, one out of three houses in Paris, France, are lit by Nigerian uranium. The damn Eiffel Tower lights up every night because of Nigerian uranium, whereas the people in Niger can't depend on electricity for 5 minutes out of each day. So this is what people are resisting in the Sahel, and the latest coup d'etats that took place in Mali and Burkina Faso are examples of the popular will. Now, what we have to see and what, you know, the comrades are working to accomplish is that we want those coup d'etats to advance to the point where they're popular movements that are, you know, controlled and directed by the masses of people and not just military coup d'etats. And time will tell if that's what happens. But the point that we want to make sure people see about this is that France holds 50% of the operating revenue from all of those countries I mentioned in an operating account that they use. They charge Haiti the equivalent of $20 million a year, which is a significant chunk of Haiti's national GDP. And that money is being charged for them colonizing Haiti, for them gaining their liberation from France, the Haitian people gaining their liberation from France. So France is a criminal empire, like the U.S. and like all of these capitalist countries. So the mass resistance that's happening in the Sahel needs to be supported and duplicated all over the world. We need to do everything we can here in the United Snakes of America to link up with that struggle. In the APRP, we already are linked up with it, but we need to, our work is to expand that so that we can begin to build resistance centers all over the world. And we sit here in the belly of the beast. We have a critical role to play in stopping this beast from being able to function.
It kind of ties into the question. Within the last couple of days, Kenyan troops appeared on the ground in Haiti, as
right.
well as Nairobi is going up in smoke. Can you speak
right.
to what is going on with William Ruto? He just got some kind of preferred status by Biden with his last mm-hmm. trip to the United States. Many people in his country are calling him a puppet of the United States. What's your mm-hmm. analysis of what he's doing in Haiti as well as what he's doing or not doing in his own country?
The legitimizing of these movements is when they take on that mass character. It can't just be a coup d'etat or a country sending troops. It has to be a mass movement that's based in principles of justice, right? So what the core issue in Haiti is that the people of Haiti have been punished by imperialism since 1804 when they had the Haitian Revolution, and this continues to this day. And the only time that the Haitian people have exercised their right to self-determination is when the Lavalas Party elected Jean-Claude Aristide in the 90s, and then in the 2000s, and imperialism sabotaged that. So now the Haitian people are doing what they have done since 1804 and before. They're serving as a living example to the rest of the African people on the planet about how we need to be uncompromising in our resistance to imperialism. And this is how we believe we build this type of mass movement that we need. And then these things that are happening, you know, troops being sent here, these military coups, then they can begin to take on the mass character where they're a part of a mass movement, which we believe is a part of the worldwide Pan-African movement. But this is how we can gauge it and determine whether it's going in the direction that it needs to go. But as long as it's just a question of a military coup, then yeah, that is something that's, you know, dominated by imperialism. And that's not, you know, it can't stop there. It has to take on that mass character.
Well, you were talking about Haiti. Was that what you were talking about?
Yes, indeed. Yeah.
What do you think about William Ruto of Kenya, him sending the troops, as well as what's going on when his troops got off of the plane in Haiti? Can you talk a little bit about what was going on in Kenya?
You know, again, every country in Africa, for the most part, is a neo-colonial regime. I think that what we're seeing with the actions in Kenya, what we're seeing with some of the stuff in the Sahel, and even some of the other places, because of this mass push, some of these actions are a reflection of these leaders' desire to be seen as doing things that represent the mass desire. So that's what I mean when I say it remains to be seen. Right. But, you know, that's great if Kenya sends troops to Haiti and the purpose of those troops is to help restore democracy to Haiti. But you know how these things go. Like, without that mass character, we can't trust that. And I'm not saying that to say that, you know, to throw shade at making that effort. It could be a sincere effort. But I'm saying that the way that we know that it's going to be something that's going to be sustainable is that it has to be something that is facilitated by the masses. And that's why, you know, we call on African people all over the world to become a part of these struggles wherever you are in the world, and to link up with the organizations that are part of the struggle, like organizations like the Kenyan Revolutionary League, which is one of the grassroots revolutionary forces in Kenya. And through those type of mechanisms, we can ensure that mass participation that can hold, you know, the actions of individual leaders accountable to the masses of people, no matter what kind of pressure comes at it from imperialism down the road.
Recently, South Africa, aligned with the number of countries, have taken Israel, the Zionist State of Israel, to the International Criminal Court, as well as the International Court of Justice in The Hague.
Right.
Can you talk a little bit about that? And do you think that there is a such thing as international law, be it that they've gave a number of mandates to the Israeli government and the Israeli government hasn't stopped its genocide? What are we looking at? Is this theater? What is going on with international law if it only punishes Africans and people from South America, but does not punish the real criminals, those being imperialists in the world? What are your thoughts?
Yeah. I mean, all we have to do is look at the history, right? Like, when and where has the International Court in Hague, when has that entity punished the U.S. for anything? When has it punished Israel for anything? It's never happened. And the reason why it doesn't happen is if you look at the structure of these organizations, whether it's the United Nations, you know, the World Court, whether it's the International Monetary Fund, the World Bank, all of these entities are financed by somebody. And in the case of all of those I named, a large percentage of the income, their operating income, comes from the United States of America. So they're not going to be taking a stand against this country, no matter what it does. They're not going to do that. And in the case of the UN and some of these other, you know, that's why the US and Israel, they're the ones that have the veto power. They control whatever happens. So I think your statement about it being theater, that's really quite accurate. Like, it's really designed to give the impression that there's justice in the world, but there's no international law and justice for the majority of people on the planet Earth. That will only happen when we create that. So this is the same as the other examples we gave in Kenya, in Haiti, in the Sahel. What Azania, South Africa, like, there are clearly all types of questions about what the African National Congress is doing as a government in Azania, or what they call by the colonial name South Africa, compared to what they represented when they were a liberation movement against apartheid up through the 90s. There are plenty of questions about the credibility of their leadership today. But even despite that, they have had to take a correct position against Zionist Israel because of the will of the masses of people in Azania, South Africa. So this is where the power comes from. The more we build that mass movement, the more it forces even neo-colonial reactionaries to take a position on the right side of history. But it can't stop there. It has to continue in the person in Azania, like I mentioned, Kenyan Socialist League in Kenya. In Azania, it's organizations like the Pan-Africanist Congress and the Azanian People's Organization. These are the types of organizations that have been pushing an anti-Zionist line since the 1950s. And the government is being forced, because of the correctness of that, to take a position that's consistent with justice. So this is why we continue to say we need more of that type of mass effort. Because, you know, in the APRP, the PAC and AZAPO, that's us in Azania. So we know what work they've done since the 1950s to bring this type of consciousness together. And so we want to increase that, you know, and eventually maybe some of these people will end up being solid people who represent the principles of justice. Maybe they won't, but we'll have that kind of mass movement that'll continue to build that kind of stability and capacity so that we can march right over their chests.
What are your thoughts about the ANC basically losing the majority at this recent election and having to share right. power with a white political party in
right.
Azania, aka South Africa? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I mean, it says a lot about how people view the ANC since 1984. A lot of people view the ANC as having capitulated on many questions around justice, created typical imperialist agenda around supporting the car manufacturing companies that do business there, and all the Beers, Diamonds, and all these crooks and criminals who rob and steal African resources blind. And the masses of African people are sick of that. We're sick of being oppressed. We're begging these people for jobs when the products that these people are producing come from the same place that we were stolen from, Africa. So people are reflecting that reality. And I think, you know, the people in the ANC, I believe they have an option. Like, they can either say that we want to get on the side of justice that we believe is represented by organizations that broke away from the ANC years ago, the Pan-Africanist Congress, the Azanian People's Organization, for example, and say that we're going to take a position that's anti-imperialist, that's anti-capitalist. They have the decision to make about whether they do that. I think eventually, as this mass movement swells, gradually, they will either make that decision and they can continue to become more and more relevant again and have more credibility, or they won't make that decision and eventually the people will question them.
That was J.R. Valray of Block Report Radio and Ajamu Umi of the All African People's Revolutionary Party. J.R. Valray's work is at www.blacknewworldmedia.com, and the African People's Revolutionary Party is at aaprp-intl.org.
Come on.
Siru. This is Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm Akua Holt. On June 26, the Bolivian people and the democratic government neutralized a military coup attempt. Pacifica's Don DeBar spoke to independent journalist Camila Escalante.
A failed coup attempt in Bolivia raises many questions about who exactly is on which side. The former general commander of Bolivia's army, Juan José Zuniga, was removed from his position. He's been charged with an attempted coup after he deployed a military operation in Plaza Murillo in the capital city of La Paz, aiming to strip power from the constitutional government. It's claimed that Zuniga broke into the presidential palace after a tank broke down the main door, while Bolivian militias prevented free movement of people and sprayed tear gas on civilians who approached government headquarters. Support for the president was offered by governments in the region, including Cuba, Venezuela, Mexico, Colombia, Brazil, Honduras, Chile, Paraguay, Ecuador, Uruguay, Panama, the Dominican Republic, and Peru. For more on that, we go to Nicaragua to speak with journalist Camila Escalante. Camila, there's some very confusing things going on here. There's an attempted coup that's defeated. The president remains in power. There's been a battle inside his party, which is actually a coalition between himself and Evo Morales and others. Help us understand what we're looking at.
Yeah, I think a lot of people were surprised by what took place. We saw the sort of the Plaza Murillo, the central government palace area of La Paz, filled with armored vehicles and military, and they actually ended up ramming down the doors of the government palace in order for this rogue commander, ex-commander of the armed forces, to be able to speak to Luis Arce and his ministers, supposedly, and demand that they resign. He said that he was going to be taking power, imposing his own democracy, and installing new ministers. So that happened in a very brief period of time. We're talking about just a number of hours on Wednesday afternoon. But before this took place, this former military leader, Juan José Zuniga, he went on air on broadcast television, Bolivian national media, and he gave a couple of very bizarre, absurd interviews of political character. This is the head of the armed forces. We know it's very strange when someone goes on and makes such specific claims and statements. He made claims judging weighing the possibility and responding to the possibility that Evo Morales participate as candidate of the MAS in 2025. He said that it would be his duty and the duty of the armed forces to protect democracy in that instance. He essentially said in many ways, because these were quite long statements that he made, that he would prevent Evo Morales from participating in the election. And so that stirred a lot of controversy. It was actually denounced internationally that he made such threats against Evo Morales, of course, the leader of the Movement Towards Socialism and the president of Bolivia for three terms previously. So following that, he was removed from office. Then he was removed from office just a day before all of this took place. But he actually showed up on Wednesday morning to sort of continue his normal functions as the head of the armed forces. That was really bizarre. And hours later, he showed up at the government palace, of course. So we don't
really understand. Let me get it clear. So he got fired today, and tomorrow he shows up for work.
Precisely. He seemed to have denied and rejected the claims in the media that he was removed from his charge. So it's difficult to understand what happened. People are asking a lot of questions about that. But we know that this is someone who has largely adopted or regurgitated a lot of the lines that we hear in the right-wing opposition media in Bolivia. And so it's really bizarre, on its face, that the government of Luis Arce would have installed such military leadership, particularly just years after we saw the coup that took place in 2019. Obviously, that points to an issue with the lack of restructuring of the military. But the other important context is that we don't know in what way the United States and its embassy in La Paz might have had a hand in this. And the question is, what is their role? Anytime there's destabilization or coup attempt in Latin America, we have to ask, where are the Yankees? Where are the gringos in all of this? Because of course we know that the right wing has an interest in destabilizing the country and dividing the MAS, the movement towards socialism, which is this broad left movement in the country that is led by Evo Morales, and members of the Luis Arce government, of course, were also brought to power under the umbrella of the MAS party. And so there are forces both within the country and outside the country that are trying to sow further division among the left, knowing that they're headed to elections next year and that the right wing, which has always itself been divided and in shambles, only has a chance at winning power through these undemocratic means and through, you know, dividing the strongest political organization in the country. And so there's a lot of questions going on right now, like, or being asked right now, in addition to the investigations that the government and the authorities are carrying out. They're arresting, they have arrested two of the main actors who carried out the actions on Wednesday, but they're also investigating others, because we're talking about possibly hundreds of heavily armed soldiers who followed commands of someone who wasn't even in power in the military anymore, and they went to Plaza Murillo to carry out a coup attempt. So where are those arrests? Where are those charges? What did they really think was going to happen? And how was it resolved so quickly? There are all sorts of different questions being asked today.
You know, it's real interesting to look at the media coverage around this. Between the Associated Press here, and the reporting from La Paz, and then say like El País in Bolivia, for example, and other media there. The AP was reporting 3-4 days ago that, you know, protesters were pouring into La Paz, and that there, I guess it was a week, as you mentioned, of like a walking protest along the National Highway, 60-mile march from the mountain. It seems like the same kind of background information that the Times and the AP and others were publishing around the time of the 2002 coup attempt in Venezuela. You know, they stir up an image of unrest, and then there's an incident that happens, and it throws everything into disarray, and then someone gets hold of the media on the ground there. And so the people only know what comes through that. In 2002, they seized, was it Channel 8 or whatever it was? It was the only government-owned media outlet, and all the private ones were on the side of the coup makers. People are sitting bewildered on the ground. We're up here in North America even more bewildered over a story like this one in El País that says coup d'etat, Zuniga falls and raises the doubt of a self-coup. In other words, who's cooing who is kind of the thing behind that. And then this press release from MAS also raises some, you know, contradictions, questions. What do you see looking at that?
Well, everything we're talking about has transpired within the last 24 hours. So there's a lot of speculation to be done, and particularly because people in the country know and feel that the support levels for the government are obviously not as high as they were when this government won the elections in November 2020 and democracy returned to the country, having received 55% of the vote. And so things aren't as easy going right now. A lot of the former ministers and leaders of the government under Evo Morales are no longer there under Luis Arce. And so there are some people who are a little bit unhappy with the way things are going. They say that this government has drifted a bit away from what their popular mandate was and what they had voted for in those elections. But nevertheless, they're supporting their government because they say this is a democratically elected constitutional government. But, you know, you have a little bit of, opposition from the right and the far right, and you have some distrust from the left wing of the country as well. And so people are sort of asking, what is the government trying to accomplish with all of its political moves? And I think that going into 2025, and Luis Arce, of course, hopes to be reelected as president, they're, you know, speculating about some sort of stunt that could have been carried out. Mm-hmm. And so we've yet to hear, because it's been such little time, what sort of analysis the left wing of Bolivia has. We really haven't heard from Evo Morales. He's only denounced the coup attempt and has called on social movements to protect this government. But we haven't really heard anything else so far. We're waiting to hear from the movement towards socialism. We heard some senators come out last night saying that, you know, they say that some of the circumstances in which this was carried out and the way it was carried out was quite unusual for a coup, and that some of the elements were not present that we normally see when there is a destabilization attempt, either by the right wing at home or involving international actors such as the United States. So I think we just have to wait and see on that.
That was independent journalist Camila Escalante speaking to Pacifica's Don DeBar. Soy Boliviano, Suyari. You're listening to Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm your host, Akua Holt. Frederick Douglass delivered a speech on July 5, 1852, to a group of abolitionists, reminding them that the Declaration of Independence represented an unfulfilled promise for African captives. Here is Phil Darius Wallace reading excerpts from the speech at a program organized by the U.S. National Archives and Records.
Fellow citizens, he who could address this audience without a quailing sensation has stronger nerves than I have. I do not ever remember to have appeared before anyone more shrinkingly, nor with greater distrust of my abilities than I do this day. The fact of the matter is, ladies and gentlemen, the distance between the platform and the slave plantation from which I escaped is considerable, and the difficulties in getting from the latter to the former are by no means slight. That I am here today, to me, is a matter of astonishment as well as of gratitude. With little experience and less learning, I've managed to place my thoughts hastily and imperfectly together, and trusting to your patient and generous indulgence, I shall proceed to lay them before you. This, for the purpose of this celebration, is the 4th of July. It is the birthday of your national independence. It is to you what the Passover was to the emancipated people of God. It carries your minds back to that day and to the act of your great deliverance. May the patriot not hope that high lessons of wisdom, of justice, and of truth shall yet guide her in her destiny. Were America older, the patriot's heart might be sadder, the reformer's brow heavier. America's future might be shrouded in gloom, and the hope of her prophets go out in sorrow. There is consolation in the thought that America is young. Fellow citizens, pardon me and allow me to ask, why am I called upon here to speak to you today? What have I, or anyone I represent, to do with your national independence? Are the great principles of political freedom and natural justice embodied in that Declaration of Independence extended to us? Am I to confess the benefits and express devout gratitude resulting from the blessing of independence to us? Would to God, for both your sakes and ours, an affirmative answer would truthfully be returned to the question. Then would my labor be light and my burden easy and delightful. For who would not lend his voice to the hallelujahs of a nation's jubilee when the chains of servitude had been torn from its limbs? But such is not the state of the case. I say, with a sad sense of disparity between us, I am not included within the pale of your glorious anniversary. Your high independence only reveals the immeasurable distance between us. The rich inheritance of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness bequeathed by your forefathers is shared by you, not me. The sunlight that brought life and health to you brought stripes and death to me. This 4th of July is yours, not ours. You may rejoice. We must mourn. And to drag a man in fetters in the grand illuminated Temple of Liberty and call upon him to join you in joyous anthems is inhuman mockery and sacrilegious irony. Do you intend to mock me, fellow citizens, by calling me here to speak to you today by the rivers of Babylon? Yea, we sat down. Yea, we wept when we remembered Zion. We hung our harps on the willows in the midst thereof. For they who led us away captive required of us a song, and they who wasted us required of us mirth, saying, sing that song of Zion. But how should we sing the Lord's song in a strange land? Oh, Jerusalem, if I forget thee, may my right hand forget her cunning. And if I do not remember thee, may my tongue cleave to the roof of my mouth. Fellow citizens, beyond your national and tumultuous joy, I hear the mournful wailing of millions whose chains, grievous yesterday or today, rendered more intolerable by the jubilee shouts that reach them. If I do forget, if I do not remember, the bleeding children of sorrow May my right hand forget her cunning, and may my tongue cleave to the roof of my mouth, to forget them and to pass lightly over their wrongs and chime in with the popular theme is treason, most scandalous and shocking, and would make me a reproach before God and the world. My subject then, fellow citizens, is American slavery. The simple story is that 76 years ago, the people of this country were British subjects. Your fathers deemed the English government as the home government and England as the fatherland. The home government did impose upon its colonial children such burdens and restraints as it deemed wise, right, and proper. But your fathers, who had not chimed in with the popular idea of the day of the infallibility of government, began to differ with those burdens and restraints. They went so far in their excitement as to pronounce the English government as unruly, unjust, and oppressive, and altogether such as not ought to be quietly submitted to. And I scarcely need say, fellow citizens, that my opinion of those measures fully accords with that of your fathers. To say now that America was right and England wrong is exceedingly easy. For there was a time when to pronounce against England and in cause of the colonies tried men's souls. Those who did so were called makers of mischief, agitators, rebels, dangerous men. But your fathers were brave men, statesmen, patriots and heroes, and for the good they did and the cause they stood for, I will stand with you to honor them in their memory. Feeling themselves unjustly treated, they earnestly sought redress. They petitioned and they remonstrated. They did so in a decorous, loyal, and respectful manner. But oppression makes a wise man mad. Your fathers were wise men, and if they did not grow mad, they grew restive under this treatment. They felt themselves the victims of grievous wrongs, wholly incurable in their colonial capacity. It was just at this time that the idea of total separation of the colonies from the crown was born, resolved, that these united colonies are and of right ought to be free and independent states, that they are absolved from all allegiance to the British crown, and that all political connection between the colonies and the state of Great Britain is and ought to be dissolved. Friends, your fathers made good that resolution. They love their country better than they love their own private interests. They stake their lives, their fortunes, and their sacred honor all in the cause of liberty. They seized upon eternal principles and set a glorious example in their defense. Mark them, their solid manhood stands out all the more as we contrast it with these degenerate times. Shall we take a look at this day with its popular characteristics? From the slave's point of view, what to the American slave is your 4th of July? I answer, it is a day that reveals to him more than any other day of the year the gross conduct and cruelty to which he is the constant victim. To him, your celebration is a sham. You know what is a swine drover? I'll show you a man drover. They inhabit all of our southern states. They perambulate the country and crowd the highways of the nation in droves of human stock, armed with pistol, whip, and bowie knife, driving 100 men, women, and children. These wretched souls are to be sold singly or in lots to suit purchasers. They are food for the cotton field and the deadly sugar mill. March the sad procession as they move along, and the savage wretch who drives them. See the old man with locks thin and gray. See the young woman whose shoulders are bare to the scorching sun. Her briny tears falls on the brow of the babe in her arms. See, too, the young girl of 13 weeping as she thinks of her mother from whom she's been torn. Mark the sad procession Heat and sorrow nearly consumes their strength. Suddenly you hear a quick snap, like the discharge of a rifle. The fetters clank, the chains rattle. Your ears are saluted with a scream that seems to have torn its way into the center of your soul. The crack you heard was the sound of a whip. The scream you heard was the mother with the babe in her arms. Her strength had faltered under the weight of the chains and the child, and the gash in her shoulder tells her to move on. Follow the procession to New Orleans. Attend an auction there. See men examined like horses. See the frames of women rudely and brutally exposed to the shocking gaze of American slave buyers. Tell me, citizens, where under the sun can you witness such a spectacle more fiendish and shocking? Yet this is but a glimpse of the American slave system as it exists in the ruling part of the United States. But it is just in this moment when I hear someone in my audience say, it is just at this time that you and your fellow abolitionists failed to make a favorable impression upon the public mind. If you would argue more and denounce less, if you would persuade more and rebuke less, your cause might be much more likely to succeed. But I submit, where all is plain, there's nothing to be argued. What point in the anti-slavery creed would you have me argue? Am I to argue the point that the slave is a man? The point is conceded already. Nobody doubts it. Slaveholders themselves acknowledge it in the enactment of the laws of their government. They acknowledge it when they punish a slave for disobedience. There are 72 crimes in the state of Virginia which, if committed by a black man, may subject him to the punishment of death, while only 2 of those same crimes, if committed by a white man, may subject him to like punishment. What is this but the acknowledgement that the slave is a moral, intellectual, and responsible being? Southern statute books are filled with enactments teaching the slave under severe fines and penalties how to read and to write. When you can point to any such laws as it relates to the beasts of the field, then I will consent to argue the manhood of the slave, Americans. Your Republican politics, as well as your Republican religion, is fragrantly inconsistent. You boast of your love for liberty, your high civilization, your pure Christianity, while all the while the whole political power of the nation conspires to hold in bondage 3 million of its countrymen. You celebrate fugitives from abroad. You honor them with banquets. You toast them. You salute them. You bless them. But of your own fugitives at home, you advertise, you hunt, arrest, shoot, and kill. You mourn fallen hungry. You make her wrongs the subject of your poets, your orators, and your statesmen. But of the 10,000 wrongs committed against the American slave, you enforce the strictest silence and would deem him an enemy of the nation that would make their subject public discourse. You say that all men are created of one blood and that all men everywhere should love one another, yet you notoriously hate those whose skin is not colored like your own. You proclaim before the world and before the world proclaim, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal and have been endowed by their creator with certain inalienable rights, and that of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Yet you hold in bondage a seventh part of the inhabitants of your country. Friends, the existence of slavery in this country brands your republicanism a sham, your humanity a base pretense, your Christianity a lie. It destroys your moral power abroad. It corrupts your politicians at home. It saps the very foundation of religion. It makes your name a hissing and a byword to a mocking earth.
That was Phil Darius Wallace reading excerpts from Frederick Douglass's speech delivered July 5th, 1852 to a group of abolitionists in Rochester, New York. Visit the U.S. National Archives and Records to learn more.
Oh, say, can you see by the blood in the streets that this place doesn't smile on you, colored child, whose blood built this land? Sweat and their hands, but you'll die in this place, and your memory erased. Oh. This is not the land of the free. But
Jill Scott, singing her rendition of the national anthem at the Essence Festival. And that concludes today's edition of Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. We thank all of Pacifica's sister stations and affiliates who contribute to the production of this show. Today's program was produced by the Capitalism, Race, and Democracy Collective with contributions from J.R. Valray, Akul Holt, Don DeBar, and Paulina Vasiliev. You can find this and all previous episodes at our website, capitalismraceanddemocracy.org. Make sure you click the subscribe button. Follow us on X, formerly Twitter, at PacificaCRD. I've been your host, Akua Holt. Thanks for listening.